Good morning and welcome to Bodies and Souls, the space in which you hear authentic conversations from real Jewish women talking about topics that are relevant to you. You're going to walk away from this conversation inspired, connected, and feeling uplifted. Today we have Miriam Roskin with us. Miriam is going to talk to us about her journey through an eating disorder, what it's like to develop an eating disorder, to live with an eating disorder, and to overcome an eating disorder. We're going to talk about our relationship with food, exercise, and the world around us. But most importantly, we're going to talk about freedom and Chassidus and how that was her guiding light through this journey. So without further ado, here is Miriam.
Good morning and welcome to Bodies and Souls. Your host for today is Rivki Boyarsky. Today I have the pleasure of having Miriam Roskin here with us from Pomona. Miriam is known as Freedom Dancer on social media. She runs a series of workshops talking about her journey from having an eating disorder towards living an elevated and connected life through the teachings of Chassidus. So Miriam, before we start, tell us a little bit about yourself and what led you to doing the work that you're doing.
Okay, so you introduced me already, the basics, so I'll just go into the work that I'm doing. I started off with eating disorder, which later not really dealt with what the causes were, led to anxiety and depression as an older married woman. And then when I got through that and realized what was causing it, I wanted to share that with everyone because I was able to access this freedom and knowing which direction Hashem wants me to go and connect so much more with my life, with my children, with everyone, and most of all with Torah and Chassidus. It had always been something that was irrelevant to me. I wasn't a bad girl. I didn't go off the derech or anything, but I just lived my life in a very kind of numb way. And when I was able to get through this whole saga, I was able to suddenly really feel every detail of my life and every part of Torah and Chassidus come alive to me. So that's what I share now in my workshops.
So you talk about this saga of an eating disorder. So I will say that as someone who taught high school and someone who's in healthcare, I think that this is a conversation that we might not be having as much as we really should, which is surprising because we've kind of been having this periphery conversation about eating disorders for many, many years, but we've never really gone into it in a real way. And I think a part of that is because still societally, like there's a sense of fear and weight stigma and fat phobia. And so if somebody's on the other end of the spectrum with an eating disorder, we're like, okay, they're fine, right? They're eating healthy food. They're at a healthy, quote unquote, like my air quotes are on, you know, healthy weight. They're doing what they need to do. And we're almost like, okay, they're fine. So I think it's a very interesting and important and relevant conversation. And I've absolutely seen, you know, girls struggling with this and this affecting their reproductive health and this affecting their sense of well-being and this affecting, you know, all parts of who they are. And just like you're saying, it kind of gives you a sense of control, but it still leaves you with this deep sense of numbness. And I think that we really have to have important conversations like this so that we can help people that they don't have to go through life, you know, doing the struggle on their own.
Most of all, when we help others with this, we realize what within ourselves is not so fully aligned. That why are young girls and teens suffering from this is it comes from the top down, and we come to realize what's really going on.
I love that, because when I do my puberty talks, I always tell schools, I'm not just going to come and talk to your girls. I must talk to the mothers, because I get the girls for 45 minutes. But the mothers get the girls for a lifetime, and we need to talk about what our biases are and what's holding us back and what our relationship is with ourselves and with our food and with our bodies and with, you know, our sense of self. And that changes the conversation for our daughters in a very,
exactly,
very way. Yeah. I love that you brought that in. It's something that actually Ruchama from Mass taught me when I started doing this work. And I think it's a piece that we miss way too often, that it's always multi-generational, especially when girls are developing.
When I go into a classroom, because I just shared my talk on, I don't know, last week with some high school girls, they were like, but our teachers even talk to us like this. Like the teacher walks in every day and comments on this girl's body weight and that she doesn't stop eating and whatnot, like that she's too
or
thin.
Or on her
and, like,
own. I've seen.
Or on her own, yeah. And like, and her own stories and her own issues and whatever. And the way I try to come into the classrooms as, you know, when I'm talking to the high schoolers is like, you could change the way your parents and the world, you're going to be the change. That's what I try to give them over, because yeah, I would love if their parents change, and Be'ez Hashem, they will, but I want to empower them that they are able to change everything that's been going on until now. Like, they could retroactively, and they're going to be the change for the future. That's kind of like my go-to when I come to the classroom. You could do this. You could do this.
And they can, because honestly, yeah. Like, I see a lot of the young moms, also like in my postpartum groups, and the narrative is changing. And I think it's such a beautiful thing to watch. Do I think it's changing for everyone? Do I still think the bubbies are coming in? Yeah. And I mean, of course they are. And they're like, Shefla, you know, eat more. Or they're sitting and watching the kids eating, or they're saying, you know, you ate too much. It's one or the other.
It's never right.
Like, balance. It's like, I went recently to an older relative's house, and they sat and like watched me eat. And I like, it was the most out of body experience. Cause I was like, I didn't grow up with someone doing that. And I like, afterwards, the next day, they had spoken to another older relative that I met for lunch. And she was like, oh, they told me you only eat. I was like, that should not be a discussion. Like, this is an eating disorder in the making. Can we talk about this? But it's very interesting. And I think some part of this, and maybe we'll get to this, you know, at some point in our conversation, some part of this is intergenerational trauma of food scarcity, right? Like, some part of that is going to be about, like, you know, there was an element of you got to finish your plate because I grew up without food and I need to make sure you're eating. And, you know, the old Russian bubby who's, you know, feeding the kids and like making sure that they're eating. And, you know, this is a love language. This is the way that they, you know, express, I love you so much, I'm going to feed you. And then there's the opposite end of like, oh,
exactly.
And we all have to fit into the beautiful dress because she's like, you look so good like that. And why should your beautiful face be on a body that doesn't work? Right. That doesn't work. Like, I should say the words. Like,
it's
like
both ways.
Yeah. So what led you personally? Let's talk about your journey a little bit. What led you to develop an eating disorder? And I'm sure we're not isolated into like this one incident, right?
When I share, I know no other person is going to have my exact story. The reason I share is for others to find in their lives what caused them to slowly move out of who they are and try to control parts of their life because of the overwhelming emotions. So what led me personally, when I look back, there was a bunch of changes in my life. It was around fifth, sixth grade. I had older sisters that got married that year. It was a change in the school from one teacher to six teachers, which meant that instead of having a relationship with the teacher, it was about my grade on the paper. There was a thing that happened to me. I don't share what exactly it was, but something happened at that age that caused me a lot of shame. And when I shared this with my class, I remembered afterwards. So I came back the next day and I told them, I said, many times something shameful could happen to us or we do something shameful. So it works either way, but everyone's going to go through stuff that they made wrong decisions or something happened to them that makes them feel ashamed. Either way, it doesn't really matter what it is. And this accumulation of this shamefulness is too much for us. We don't know how to deal with it. We weren't given tools to deal with it. And so we try to become something else. We lock that part down and we try to control things. So for me, it was that particular incident together with not having support in my life that I went to a clothing store to buy uniforms and the person in the store kept bringing me the next size up. So in my mind, the story started in the uniform store. But looking back, it really started from all these changes in my life. And every time they brought me the next size, the waist stayed the same, but the skirt got longer, which they never change. They still do that. I'm like, at least make it elastic. Wait,
Jewish stores are not, I don't know who designs Jewish clothing, but it's not designed for healthy children. Like, it's just not designed in a way that actually makes any sense. So the kid just looks schlumpier and schleppier and the waist is not
if actually. If they're a little bit bigger, like waist, that's it. I like it gets long and thin.
Really?
And women's clothing as well.
Laffy taffy, right? Like it just stretches out. Like it's the only thing that happens that you're allowed to do in the from store is Laffy Taffy out. That's it.
Even post, my youngest are twins. So post having them, I went to the Jewish clothing store 3 months after. I felt like I was almost back to my size. Couldn't find a thing. Everything was long and thin. And I was like, now I really understand why people can't find clothing in the Jewish stores. Like, you go to any other store, there's elastic, there's, you know, you could put a belt to it, you know, something, whatever. Anyway, so I go to the clothing store and my sister was with me. They keep bringing me the next size and it's not closing. And I ended up just buying like a biggish kind of skirt, but it still wasn't comfortable. And I decided I must need to lose weight. That must be why. Like, I can't even fit into the normal clothing size. I must need to lose weight. So I started being a very good dieter, or what I thought. I didn't consult with anyone, but I got so many compliments. This was like development stage, you know, when you're that awkward 9, 10, 11-year-old, you know, and then suddenly I'm this like lanky, very thin 12-year-old. So like it looked good. But afterwards, when I went to school for nutrition and dietetics, I'll get to that soon, we learned that pre-puberty, that age 9, 10, and 11, you are supposed to gain weight. You're supposed to. Your hormones need the extra fat. And in my family, it was a source of shame because we all gained that weight from 9 to 12. We all mature pretty young, whereas friends of mine maybe were more like 16, 17. I was at 12, and most of my family was like that. Like the whole family would comment, oh yeah, you're gaining that 9-year-old weight. Like, you know, and so I was suddenly thin and I felt very proud of myself and I got so many nice compliments and all was great. And then it became not so great. Within like a year or two, my parents began to like comment, no, you need to eat more. You're not eating enough. I had stopped getting my periods. And I was insistent that I was fine because my body weight was fine. Again, when I went to school for nutrition and dietetics, they changed the criteria for anorexia and eating disorders. You could be overweight and anorexic. Does not matter. But in my mind, I was very well versed in the nutrition magazines. I was in the right BMI. I was fine. And I didn't see a problem with what I was doing. Yeah, so that's pretty much what led to the eating disorder.
So I want to help our listeners focus on 3 points. The first point was how young you were where this started. You would speak about being in fifth and sixth grade. So just for context, that's around 11 years old, 10, 11 years old. That's a very young child. And I do think that eating disorders can start at that age. And I've actually seen it start younger as well. So just in case you think it's only people who are 16, 17 who are having these type of, you know, challenges, know that it can start at a younger age. The second thing I want to point out is that you spoke about control. I was hoping you would talk about control a little bit, which you did, that this gave you a sense of control when life became chaotic and life became overwhelming. You controlling your food helped you get a sense of control. And I think that this is a big part of why a lot of young women fall into this pattern, which is they're just feeling out of control for whatever reason, whether it was a trauma, whether life became chaotic, there was a big move, you know, they just, you know, maybe their parents are overbearing, whatever it is, those things can then lead someone to say, you know, I need to have a sense of control. Maybe food is something that I could control. And that does not just work into controlling how little I eat, but actually maybe even controlling how much I get to eat, right? So it can go in either direction.
On that point of control, you're just, as you're saying that, you're reminding me, I don't know if you've ever read The Choice.
Yes, but eat it.
Okay. So she has this point, she says, like, go back in your mind to when your childhood had ended. And, you know, your adulthood started. When did your innocence end? And I think maybe this is the space where we get into that space of control because we don't know what to do with it. When that innocence changes and suddenly you have a lot to deal with, most people will choose some way of trying to control their life. And for some people, it's an eating disorder. Other people, it's going to be something else.
Right. And that's a very important thing for us to start noticing. And, you know, at a certain age, our kids do need to, you know, be able to control parts of their lives and feel like a sense of control and ownership. And the third point I want to bring to you is that you actually mentioned a very good point, and I mentioned this when I do puberty talks, which is that it is normal and healthy to gain weight. And I actually say a number. About 20 pounds. So on a little kid who's hitting puberty, 20 pounds can feel like a lot. That's a big jump, but it's absolutely necessary to have, like you were mentioning, those fat stores so that you then have a healthy reproductive and adolescence growth. And that's very, very important. So I want parents who are listening who might be looking at someone who is a preteen or in their early teenage years and they're like, oh my gosh, they gained so much weight. You don't have to say anything. Just wait a minute. They're going to do what they need to do. Hashem created our bodies that we do as women need fat stores. Our breasts are fat. Our hips are fat. Our hip, our bottom has to be a little bit more round. Our stomachs have to be. These are healthy things. This is how we support healthy growth and development. It's exactly how our bodies are supposed to look.
Hormones rely on fat.
100%.
Yes.
And that's really, really, really important for us to understand. So if you don't mind me asking, Miriam, and totally gloss over this if it's something that's uncomfortable, what type of eating disorder did you have? And what was it like living with an eating disorder?
Okay, so like I mentioned before, when I went to school, they told me the criteria changed. So if I were to go back, I never got diagnosed. So I also, like when I share it, I say I had disordered eating because I never got diagnosed with it. But if I look back as a dietitian now, it was a nutritionist. I can't call myself a dietitian. That's another thing. It was anorexia because it was limiting food intake and control on food. There's bulimia, which is more like trying to numb feelings by just ingesting a lot of food. So it wasn't that, you know, that's pretty much what I sum up that it was. So I was a pretty much happy-go-lucky child, very much giggly all the time. My neighbors used to love to make me laugh and whatever. And around sixth grade, when this started, a classmate commented to me how, like, Miriam, what happened to you? Like, that's all she said. What happened to you? And that was the first moment I realized that I wasn't acting the same or, you know, I became a lot more serious. My grades went from pretty much an A student to like C's or lower. I had no involvement in class. I don't know if that had to do with one teacher and six teachers or with the eating disorder. I still don't know. But I think a lot had to do with being not fully present in the classroom. I was so much in my head trying to control and think how many calories to get through the day and how little could I eat, but how much do I need to have enough energy to get through the day? Like that was my constant calculation in my mind. When I went to camp, I couldn't sleep at night. I had insomnia, I think because the lack of calories together with I just didn't have the hormone balance to be able to relax enough. I didn't have serotonin. Like there wasn't any flash in me to fall asleep. Ball games, I would get dizzy after. If I went swimming, I would feel so faint. I would try to sneak into the nurse's office and weigh myself. Going to camp was so scary for me because at home I had a scale and knew what I was. In camp, I didn't. So I would try to sneak into the nurse's office to weigh myself. But that wasn't allowed. So I would like go before hours and try to weigh myself. So even more so, I would limit even more and try to exercise more because I had no idea what weight I was, like if I had any control. That was pretty much it. Like going from the more easy personality to very tense and the uninvolvement in my life. Like hanging out with friends was non-existent because you're usually chatting over food and nosh. I would like try to go to sleep in camp and everyone would be up for bringing and partying. And I would just be like, just help me fall asleep, Hashem, because just numbness, complete numbness and no joy. There wasn't a joy. It was just survive to get to the next day, to get to the next day.
Just uncovering our biases a little bit as I'm listening to you. I think most people listening would be like, oh, if I was the camp nurse and a kid snuck in to use the scale, I'd be like, ha ha, teenager, right? Like they're so obsessed with their body. Like, I don't even think that, like, to me, as someone who's super aware, I don't know if you had done that once and I had caught you once, but I have been like, oh, we have a serious problem. And then even if I would have said, you know, we have a serious problem to someone, I think everyone would laugh like, oh, it's just teens, you know, it's just teens. So I think just uncovering our biases a little bit to thinking about how societally obsessed we are with our weight that we're able to just excuse this type of behavior, whether we're educated or whether we're not, is something that's very important. And that comes from,
I mean, it's even promoted. If you read a health magazine, they say, like, you know, monitor your weight, have a scale in your house. It seems to be a healthy thing. That's what it's been marketed as.
100%.
And it's really not.
No, it's really, really not. And I was at the doctor's office and they had asked one of my kids to go on the scale. And I said, why do you need this kid's, like, we're not here for antibiotics. We're not here for a well visit. Why do you need their weight? And they're like, it's standard procedure. I'm like, well, it shouldn't be standard procedure. What do you need the weight for? And she was like, it's just standard. I'm like, okay, so you could write down that the mother was difficult. She refused.
Go you.
I'm like, no problem. My kid was like, Ma, maybe we should have just let it go. I'm like, maybe we should have, but you don't actually need it. And I actually spoke to a different provider in that office and I was like, maybe you should talk. She's like, I've tried. This is just how they are.
There's actually such a thing called a blind scale where.
Right. So I tell my kids to turn around. I tell my kids, like, when we go on the scale, we face the other direction. If the provider feels they need to know it for a sense of control, by the way, that's all it is, then they can have it. But it means nothing to you if you're exercising well, you're eating well, you're taking care of yourself, making sure you feel, you know, supported. And what is the number telling you? The size of your shirt? Great. You know the size of your shirt already. You're okay. Yeah. So I think that just, like, changing the culture comes from so many different places and we're not in control over all of them all the time.
But your little impact in the doctor's office could help change things. I know it's like a little comment, but if every parent came in like that, they wouldn't have it.
No, they wouldn't. So, but honestly, yeah. Like, I don't think that every parent's coming in like that.
Exactly.
But we should. There's no, like,
yes.
A little kid, we need to know their weight. We need to know they're gaining. We need to know they're growing. If a child comes in and there's weight-based antibiotics, we need to know their weight. But a child who's coming in because their arm hurts, like, why are we taking a weight? What does that have to do with anything? And she was here a month ago. You know her weight.
I mean, even pregnant women, you know, they monitor the weight like crazy. Why? What's that?
They monitor the weight, you know? When there's a big jump. Okay. But here's the difference. So a lot of midwife practices, and this is totally, we've gone off on a tangent, but this is important to talk about our biases and the healthcare system. If there's a large jump, then I would be worried about certain health conditions that are associated with a large jump. But I would also see that if you're seeing a provider continuously, I would still see that big jump. But a lot of midwife practices, what they've done now is instead of you coming in and getting weighed by someone else, is that you have ownership over the weight. So you can choose to weigh yourself in the bathroom or you can choose to defer it. And that would be a choice. And again, I think a lot of this has to do with a whole nother discussion, which is giving patients autonomy over their care rather than giving the providers an illusion of control, which we really don't have control over, which is a whole nother discussion. Exactly. But it's all, again, we're going back to this concept of control, which is the weight is giving someone a sense of control. And in this case, it's actually not you, it's the provider.
Exactly. I had experiences post everything, you know, weight to me. I don't own a scale. I don't monitor my food. I don't have anxiety now and whatever, but post everything, when I was pregnant with my twins now, the doctor would weigh me every week. And even post that, post everything I've been through and learning and, you know, and turning everything around. When he gave me a lecture between two visits, I saw him between two and he gave me such a lecture that if I gain too much weight, I won't be able to get the babies out. I was set into such a tizzy and it didn't make any logical sense because, like, if I thought about, even to him, it didn't make any logical sense why he's giving me this rundown. If you looked at the accumulation of the months that I was nauseous for the first 5 months, then of course there's like a jump from 5 to 6 because I, you know, lost weight in the beginning, whatever it was. Even if he logically looked at it better, he would see that it made sense. Even with all logical, my whole body went into fight or flight because it's a lot. You want to protect your babies. You want to not have a unnatural birth. You know, like, you don't want to be cut open and whatever. And he's giving me this whole lecture. And I had to re-come back into myself and study again. And this was another pregnancy. I met someone in the park and she's telling me her doctor asked her what she's eating every day. A very, very tiny woman, a tiny, tiny woman. And the doctor's lecturing her that she's eating too much avocado and salad for lunch. She should cut it back. And she's asking me what to do because she's like, if I don't have a good lunch, then I'm like noshing on dried mango at night. She's like, I'm a very healthy eater, but this is not enough food for me. So she's like, I like having like a big salad of like eggs and avocado and whatever. And if I don't have that, when I listen to him and cut it back, I'm like noshing on dried mango at night. And I'm like, so it's lady, important. Don't listen.
It's important to also note that your OBGYN is not a nutritionist and your OBGYN is not trained to actually give you that advice. And the advice that is given about how much weight to gain has not been updated in a super duper long time. And just because someone is overweight, that does not mean that they're going to have a large baby. If someone has gestational diabetes, there's a correlation there. But if somebody is small, they can have a large baby. If somebody is large, they can have a small baby. That is not a thing. Miriam, getting back to your journey, and I think we've moved forward to like how certain things are triggering to get you back to this.
Exactly.
A young person struggling. And I think that this was a very important thing for people to hear. What helped you move out of this space of disordered eating?
So there was like a bit of a shock that got me out of it. My brother-in-law was learning to be a PA and he was learning about eating disorders at that point. It was around age 15. And he and my sister sat me down and they said, listen, I know you think you're dieting healthy, but you're not getting your periods. Your hair is falling out. You're feeling numb, whatever, like all the symptoms I had. You're probably anorexic. If you don't start eating again, you might never have kids. You're going to have health issues. You might die. And for me, it was enough of a scare because I don't think I ever moved into that space of, I think there's like a certain point of no going back sometimes with the eating disorder, where the brain, even if someone scares the life out of them, it's not going to help. But for me, that scare was enough to make me eat again. It didn't heal my relationship with food, but I really wanted to have a large family. And I wanted to get married one day and I didn't want to die. So I started eating again, but I wasn't eating. It wasn't like I had a healthy relationship with food. So I decided, you know what? I'm going to eat like whole grains and no sugar. So I guess it moved more into orthorexia. move more into that. And which, you know, like when I was in school, everyone that's there pretty much has gone through multiple different kind of eating disorders. And most people, yeah, it would move from bulimia to anorexia to orthorexia. And there's even today, most nutritionists, a lot of them are orthorexic, unless they've taught themselves and grown and whatever. But many adults, the health conscious that you think are so healthy, it's more orthorexia, which is a very big emphasis on healthy eating. And they're scared. It's a huge fear of eating anything out of that space, anything contaminated or whatever you want to say.
I'm really glad you brought up orthorexia because I did it and then you did it as well. And I was waiting for an opportunity to talk about this. We use the word healthy eating. And I think that this is what you're talking about, which again, I'm just going to point out, this is like a bias that we have that certain foods are healthy and certain foods are unhealthy, which is kind of what that OB did, which is like, oh, avocados are in the middle, like don't eat avocados. But it's not just about good foods and bad foods, healthy foods and unhealthy foods. And it's a much more nuanced discussion. And food serves a lot of purposes other than just getting your nutrients in.
Exactly. Like I'll fast forward to the part of really healing from the eating disorder. So I moved into orthorexia. And then after I graduated from school and went to seminary, I came back home and decided to study to be a dietitian, to do the full-on, you know, college. I'm going to learn everything about the body so that all the magazines have no control over me. Like I'll be smarter than them. And I also was so curious why some people are underweight, some overweight. I wanted to be free. I didn't want food to have any control over me. I wanted to be smarter than it. And it really did do that for me going to college to learn about it. Because when I learned the science behind food and digestion, it lost all its hold on me. The teachers that I had were very much into like everything in moderation. We had one really sweet teacher who would be like, if you're going to eat chocolate chip cookies, make it with butter and white flour, you know? And that was the mentality that I got from school. And when I left school, food had no control over me. By the time I was finished, it was like, you know, a cookie and a piece of chicken, whatever my body needs right now is what's healthy for me. Like, that's what it became. And that's when I started working in a doctor's office, because I didn't end up getting my, in order to call myself a dietitian, I need my internship. And I ended up pregnant with my second child at the time and didn't do it. But I had a job waiting for me at my brother-in-law's office, the same one who told me that conversation. He hired me as a nutritionist in his office. And so I started working there. And within a few weeks, I noticed that it didn't matter if I gave a client the best nutrition plan, you know, like eat one piece of toast and one egg and what, you know, this, that, which I wasn't doing myself because it had completely no hold on me, but people were coming to lose weight. Like, that's why they came to the doctor. So I, you know, as a nutritionist, was giving them a healthy eating plan. It seemed amazing to them. They were so on board. And within 3 weeks, they were like, yeah, I don't know, I'm following it and I'm not losing weight anymore, or I can't do it anymore. I want to go back to eating my Kukkish cake, you know? And around that time, I had read in, I think it was the Ami magazine, about intuitive eating. And right away clicked that that's what I really was doing in my own life. And why was I handing the patients these nutrition plans when I was doing intuitive eating? So I learned the principles and I started teaching that they still requested their eating plan, but I tried to stick in, you know, what's here emotionally for you that is keeping you back from following healthy eating? Because you know what's healthy better than I do. Everyone knows what's healthy. They could give me a whole lecture on, you know, the best foods to eat, but why are they not doing it? And here's where I started teaching them that naturally a baby doesn't eat past fullness. You naturally know when to stop eating. You naturally know not to eat too much sugar. Your body doesn't feel good. What happens is over time, these other voices come in. No, you're eating too much. No, you're eating too little. No, no, no. And you stop listening to your internal voices. And now this is healthy, so eat the whole thing, you know, like salad is healthy, so just keep eating it. Chicken is healthy, so keep eating it. Cookies are not healthy, so you don't eat it. And then you gobble down in the closet at the end of the day. It takes away the whole enjoyment and the whole way we manage food naturally within ourselves. And we think now we have no control over eating and that we need a meal plan. That's what we think. But really, we each are built differently, just like our shoe sizes are different. And some people are heavy and some people are thin. And it doesn't matter how healthy they're going to eat, what kind of foods they're eating. It does not matter. Your body naturally goes to the weight it needs to go for the size you need to be for your mission in life. It doesn't matter. Like, that's your unique mission. And even the whole, you know, you'll read these health magazines and it'll be like, you know, be in your right BMI and eat healthy avocados and eat pomegranates today and this tomorrow, whatever it is. Even that, your health and everything is in control of Hashem. There are people that are so healthy that have a heart attack, and there are people that are so unhealthy. And I'm not saying to eat burgers and fries and whatever, but naturally we don't want that. If we're able to block out all those voices, and okay, a huge aspect here is emotions as well, which I'll get to, then we naturally could get there. The only principle that's not in the 10 principles of intuitive eating is emotion management. And that's where, for me, that's what needs the most help. When I was in school, one of our teachers was very into that really we need psychology degrees, not nutrition degrees. He's like, you're going to come in to a patient and they want to do everything right and they can't. And you have to help them unblock what's going on here. Why is the food their friend? Why is stress, you know, the stress eating or not eating, right? Why are they not eating because they're stressed, or why are they eating too much because they're stressed? What emotion is here that we're uncomfortable with that we're not listening to either to eat or not to eat? So that's really at the end of the day what it is. So I have no desire to be a nutritionist. I can't do it anymore. Like I could technically have a job in a doctor's office working as that. I have no desire to do it because I'm like, that's not what the point is. The point is people will naturally eat what they need to eat, but what's going on inside? That's what we have to work on.
So if you're listening to Miriam and you're thinking, oh, but BMI, my doctor always checks my BMI. I just want to clear up something for you. BMI was invented in the 1830s by someone who was not a medical professional. He was an astronomer and a mathematician and a statistician. The fact that in 2024, the entire medical community will base their recommendations on BMI still does not make sense. Like Miriam said, Hashem created all of us with different bodies, different eye colors, different hair colors, different body shapes, different heights. We were not created on a factory. We are not all supposed to look the same. We are not all supposed to, you know, have the same, fit into the same size. That's not a thing.
Actually, on the BMI, because you asked me earlier what got me, what happened? I told you about the uniform store, but I'm remembering now as you're saying, I remember my mother had maybe good housekeeping or whatever it was. And there was a BMI chart. And I look at it and I was too much on the BMI. And I was like, no way, this is so mortifying. I'm like, I'm not the size I'm supposed to be. I'm over my weight. That was also a huge factor I'm remembering now in like, oh, I'm not who I'm supposed to. I have to work on myself. Like I can't listen to my own body.
So where did Hasidus come into this discussion?
Okay, so now post working at that doctor's office, post figuring out about intuitive eating. Now I moved to Pomona because I was living in Brooklyn. I was finishing my degree, just, you know, had my first two kids. And then we moved to Pomona and life is beautiful. And we moved in the spring. I'm pregnant. I have two kids. I had a hard time having my first kid. So there was a lot of always wanting something, always thinking, you know, when I have that, I'll feel settled when I have that. So there was a wait for my first kid. Then now we're in a house, we're settled, right? And winter came and I'm pregnant with my third child. And the schools where, you know, where I live, and that year that I moved would close down for a little sprinkling of snow. It felt like every day school was closed and my kids, and then two and one, were home and I was pregnant with my third child. So there was no way of making myself busy and distracted because I had these two kids. It wasn't like I could even read a book or watch something or go shopping. I had these two kids with me and I'm pregnant with a third child, which makes me feel unwell. So I'm not either like reorganizing my house or reorganizing the toys. I'm literally sitting there with two kids, one who didn't stop crying and one who had a lot of energy and was jumping all around. And suddenly I broke inside and I couldn't stop crying. And my life kind of continued. I still, you know, when school did happen, I just still drove them to school. I still went shopping, still had guests for Shabbos, but all the in-betweens, I would just cry and cry. And after a few weeks of doing this, I told my husband I needed help. And then I went to see a psychologist. And as I was sitting there, first she started saying, you know, what do you do? And she's like, let's try to find you a job, whatever. And I was like, no, you're not getting it. Like, no, my life is very busy. I don't want a job right now. I felt like, what's the point of living? That was in the sense of like, I'm going to raise these kids and then they're going to do the same thing. Like, they didn't feel like a point of, it just felt so chaotic. And I felt so overwhelmed with my own emotions and with the kids' emotions and with everything that I felt like, why am I going to do this again? So the kids do the same thing for their kids. There wasn't like anything to hold on to. And I was like, no, it's not that. And then I opened up about this shameful thing that happened to me as a child. I knew I wanted to get it off my chest, which is why I asked my husband to book me with the therapist. I didn't tell him why at the time, but I asked him to book me because I wanted to get this off my chest. And I shared it with the therapist and my whole body shook. There was just like a trembling and everything came out and she just asked questions to get more and more out. And I didn't even know I had so much inside. Like I thought it was just, you know, like you have like a blip on your screen, you know, like, no, it was a lot coming out. And as you know, I maybe went for two or three like this, got it all out. And she helped me shift from a childlike understanding to an adult-like understanding because As a child, I mean, I thought, and I think most children think this, is like, you have control over your life. If whether you did a mitzvah or an aveira, you have control. You're going to choose. And I think we're brought up to believe that as well. You're punished if you do not good, and you're rewarded if you do good. So in my mind, because something shameful happened, it was my fault. Something majorly happened, and I'm like, I have to make up for this my whole life. I can't fully live my life because I have to like kind of make up for it. And she helped me see, like, you were a child. Children make mistakes. Adults make mistakes. We're human. Humans make mistakes. She's like, imagine, you know, someone in your life that age, what would you think of them if that thing happened? And I was like, I would feel so bad. I wouldn't think anything bad of them, you know, like, so help me shift from the childlike understanding that I brought into my adulthood because I didn't process it, to going back to being the adult in the situation and seeing it from the adult perspective. And when that was cleared for me, suddenly I was like light and flying and full of love and full of light. And here's where I began to learn Chassidus from people who I connected with, Rabbi Simon Jacobson, Rabbi YY, Rabbi Shace Taub. Suddenly they were talking about all my emotions that were going on within me, because I had sort of locked everything away. Because of that, it just kind of like everything morphed together, you know, one big closed lid on a container with all my emotions. And now that it was open, I was like, wow, oh my goodness, it said that in Ayayim, oh my goodness, it said that in Tanya, it said, I was like over the moon and everything was talking to me. I was so alive. And I had my third child at that point. And after I had him, which by the way was my first child, that I felt like we had a conversation going between the two of us. I just knew what he needed. You know, we felt each other. Whereas the other kids, it was like, you know, have your baby, take care of them, feed the bottle. I was a good mother. Like I took care of them, but it wasn't like this enjoyment and love for the whole process. So after I had my third child, I was in the car one day and there was a Mordechai Ben David's Yiddish song. And in my mind, I had this whole dance going on. And I always did this, even over the years, whenever music plays, especially piano music, my mind makes a dance for it, or my fingers start dancing to it. And so I'm like, I want to get home and dance. And as I was dancing, I put on that song. I realized that my phone has a selfie camera now. It was like a new idea at the time. I turned my phone around and I put it on the fireplace and I recorded me dancing. And when I watched it, I was like, you look as free as you feel. You know, it's one thing, like, you know, you feel a little elegant, but then you look at yourself and you really, you know, hot, floppy and whatever. No, it really gave that message of freedom, of letting go and allowing things to go, to flow and emotions to go. So I shared it with my mother, my mother-in-law, a little bit my husband. No one really understood what I was doing. They didn't get what it was, a friend. But here and there, people got what I was doing. And at the time, a friend who saw it, she's like, Miriam, go on Instagram. It was a new thing at the time. Go on Instagram because you could just have females follow you and you could have a page. You share your dances, you share what's going on. And that's when I started Freedom Dancer, and I would share the Chassidus I learned that connected to me, my emotions, and little clips of me dancing.
As I'm listening to you, Miriam, I'm thinking about this big concept of Chassidim were known as the Freilicher, the happy people. And it's so interesting that when you found your joy, you found Chassidus. And in that, there was like this intertwining of my joy, my Chassidus, my dance, my connection to Hashem. Like all these things, it was very interesting that that's where you found your connection. The other thing I wanted to bring up, which is so important, and you kind of said this in a lot more words, but I want to crystallize this thoughts for people who are listening, is that guilt is not a Jewish concept. I don't care how much Jewish comedians will be like, my Jewish mother guilts me. Guess what? Nowhere in Torah is guilt conducive to growth. Nowhere in Torah is that a concept that as Jews we're supposed to connect to. So if you are feeling, you know, a sense of remorse, that's a healthy thing, or a sense of ownership, or, you know, those things are great. That's exactly what we want to talk about. But guilt is not a Jewish concept. And I will tell you that even as someone who teaches kallahs who are struggling, who maybe, you know, or women who are struggling in their Yiddishkeit, they're like, yeah, but I did. And I'm like, Okay. And Tyra's not here for like, we don't do confessionals and we don't sit in our guilt and we don't flog ourselves. And like, that's not a thing.
That was, I think, one of the first concepts that I connected to with Rabbi Sima Jacobson. He was talking about exactly that. He's like, guilt is nowhere in the Torah. There's nowhere in the Torah for guilt. Throw it out the window. And I think today's Yetzirah, you know, like every generation has their Yetziraz. Our generation, as the Rebbe has said, is that we don't feel worthy. That's our Yetzirah. And a big, huge factor of that is guilt. And as you so clearly see within my own story, that it's so related how much alive we feel with Tyra, that it's not helpful at all. It's the opposite. The more guilt, the less you'll feel connected. That's pretty much the sum.
I love that. Is there another Hasidic concept that you make sure to bring across to your listeners or to your workshop attendants or through your Instagram, through the work that you're doing? Is there another Hasidic concept that you are like, hold on to this concept, because this is almost like a mantra. This is almost something that can really shift and create a paradigm shift in how we think of ourselves, our world, our connection to Hashem.
So I think what Rabbi Simon Jacobson introduced me to was this concept that when we feel safe and loved and secure, because he has you, like there's a whole imagery of like being in the womb and protected and loved, we automatically make better decisions, right? We're not in our fight or flight state. We're not trying. We naturally, like Hasidus tells us, is that we naturally are good. And so if we're naturally good, then we're not trying to protect ourselves from doing bad. We're trying to get ourselves back to a safe space to be good. Because we're naturally good.
So going back to like Hashem's arms, like the womb that we were, our neshama sat in.
Exactly. And what I started out when I started Freedom Dancer was about letting go and letting Hashem, letting go of control, because that's what's blocking us from accessing our emotions, which are really here to lead us to clear them up so that we could have that space that Hashem wants to be within us. This is a huge concept in Hasidus that the students, when I give this over, it's like a mind changer. The world was created unified. The reason for separation is so we could have a relationship with Hashem. So any sort of guilt, Hashem created you to mess up. He wanted you to mess up, to create coverings so that now you could clear it and get close to him and have a relationship. Because without that, we would dissolve into him. Like that was the whole concept of Matan Torah. That we weren't separated enough from him, and that was it. Boom, we went up to heaven. So this whole concept of creating blockages within us and then to clear them is supposed to happen. That's the process. And so this has come to really what it is. And so the original let go and let God, this is really where it's at. I don't know if I focus solely on one thing, but what I've seen so clearly this year is that I've begun to learn the last few years of the Rebbe's life when he was with us, the Sichas of Tashin and Alfin and Bays. Everything I've shared here is in those Sichas. And when I saw it so clearly written out, the Rebbe says about going out of Mitzrayim, what was going out of Mitzrayim and taking the treasures. It's about you have all those blockages within you, right? Mitzrayim is blockages. And now you have to transform it to treasures in order to go out. You're not going out before you transform them. You got to transform them. And now you can't go out yourself. You need to connect to Hashem to take you out, right? Their cry, their big cry. And now you go out of Mitzrayim. But how are you going to have your Matan Torah? What's your Matan Torah, your personal Torah? Is all those things you've learned, all those treasures, you're going to process them. And then you're going to have your Matan Torah. You're going to receive your own Torah. Because we're each here, right? 600,000 different parts to reveal our part of the Torah. So that's like really what I don't think I focus on one thing, but it's really very much bringing in that the Rebbe says everything that I share in such a beautiful way through the Torah.
I love how like these concepts that the world is connecting to now in psychology or therapy or the work that we're doing as, you know, as a society, as a whole, we've had this. We've had this for millennia. This is not a new concept. This is us connecting to the original truth and the ultimate truth rather than the fragments of truth. And I think
we didn't necessarily have the kalim to receive them. there's a reason why it's being revealed more now, why we're understanding it. It was always there. And that's our job in Torah, is to connect the dots, is to take the knowledge of the world and realize we have more in the Torah. We have the truth is in the Torah. But the things that the world teaches us helps open our minds to what it means, because they are here to help us. The world is here to help the Yidden reveal the full Torah.
I love that concept of everything is here to serve the purpose of godliness and goodness. Miriam, tell us a little bit about your workshop. Are you dancing with the people who are participating? Are you talking with them? What is the format of the work that you're doing?
So the format is sharing my story using the Rebbe's talks throughout, like bringing every single part in as it relates, while singing and showing clips of different dances I've done or different speakers that talk about that relevant topic at the time. So for high school students, I try to keep it to an hour. And for women retreats, it's more like 2 hours, and I divide it into two parts. And I conclude it with a kumzitz. You know, the girls could get up and sing. And the idea of it is a modern day farbringen. What a farbringen is to heal ourselves, to connect us to Chassidus and Torah, and to reveal our truth and our Torah that's within us. So I take the audience from what I told you with like Yetzias Mitzrayim until Matan Torah. But depending on the time of year, it changes according to, you know, like if I'm talking Shavuos time, it's going to be that sequence. But if I'm talking Sukkot time or Yetzias Kislev, I'll bring in things that the Rebbe talks about with Yetzias Kislev, which will be more like concepts of an olive being squeezed to get out the oil.
I love that. That sounds really, really beautiful and meaningful. And I think that it's absolutely beneficial because you have all this behind you in the statements, and that really holds truth. And when people see that it's something that's not far-fetched and not something that's abstract, is something that's real to you, I think that authentic connection is what really touches people. So do you have a last message that you want to leave our listeners with?
A last message. I'll just leave with a little thought that came to my mind today. I went away for the week with my husband, and we're in a beautiful place. And yesterday, I found it so hard to enjoy. It was so hard. It's a beautiful place. There's no reason, absolutely no reason to not enjoy. And I'm finding myself worrying about the kids at home. You know, did the pizza arrive in time? Did this, did that? And I was like, why can't I just let go? And this morning I did some yoga. I did some breath work. I tried to work through everything that's going on. And I realized this little idea came to mind, how imagine Geula happened today. Your body's not even ready. Like, you are ready, but are you really ready? Have you transformed all those blockages within you that you're ready to receive so much goodness? Because I'm sitting here ready to receive so much goodness, and my body is resisting. It doesn't want to enjoy. It still wants to control in some way. And that to me just kind of brings menucha into my life when I understand these understandings, like, oh my goodness, Hashem, you wanted to just tell me that message. Thank you very much. Now I could enjoy, you know? So it was a very powerful moment.
So Miriam, thank you so, so much for joining us today. This was enlightening. This was relevant. This was real. And I know I really enjoyed this conversation. So I know that our listeners will enjoy it as well. And so thank you so, so much for joining us. I'm going to put Miriam's information, her Instagram, and how to contact her for workshops in the show notes. I actually really do think that this is vital work for us to do as moms on ourselves, as people who have any standing in the community, to really like look at ourselves and unwrap our connection to our bodies and our souls and, you know, who we are, because we're changing a conversation for the next generation of women. And that's tremendously powerful, because we serve Hashem with our mind, our bodies, and our souls, not just with learning.
Absolutely.
So important. So Miriam,
thank you so much. It was such an honor and pleasure to be here today and connect so deeply with you. I felt like you understood it, and that's what helps bring everything out. So thank you so much.
And now we present to you a song by Miriam Raskin. Oh, oh, oh.
יש לכל אני חי עם האמת שמשתוללת בי עם אלף הרגלים עם כל צלקת שער פניי אני רוצה שוב לפזר את המילים בין המציאות לשיגעון הכל חוזר אליי שם במקום ממנו באתי אין שלום והמסע זה כבד וקצת גדול עליי אני צריך לגדול מזה ודי לגדול מזה לפזר את המילים בין המציאות לשיגעון הכל חוזר אליי שם במקום ממנו באתי אין שלום והמסע זה כבד וקצת גדול עליי אני צריך לגדול מזה ודי לגדול מזה ודי
for joining me on this past hour. I am so glad that you found our podcast and that we got to spend the time together. If you would like to nominate yourself or someone you know for a topic that they are interested, feel passionate about, or you feel passionate about, reach out to us at info@bodiessouls.com. Remember, that's two S's. If you have any feedback about the work we're doing, or if you would like to connect, you can use the same email. I hope you have a wonderful, uplifting, and amazing day.